This is Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
They say war is hell, but I say it's the foyer to hell. I say that a lot. I say coming home is hell, and hell ain't got no coordinates. You can't find it on the charts, because there ain't no charts. Hell is no place at all, so when you're there, you're nowhere, you're lost. The narrative, that's your chart, your own story.
That's Tyler Boudreau, reading from his book, Packing Inferno. It's about his life as a Marine and his experience fighting in Iraq, and how that changed his attitude toward war. On March 1, 2004, Captain Tyler Boudreau deployed to Iraq as the Assistant Operations Officer for a Marine Battalion out of Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. Boudreau had been in the military since 1989, taking time out only to attend college. He'd been an officer in the Naval Reserve, then enlisted as an infantryman in the Marine Corps, serving first as a rifle and weapons platoon commander, and then as a trainer to new recruits. But as long as his military experience had been, and as strong as his loyalty to the military was, Boudreau found his beliefs profoundly challenged by his experience in Iraq. Stationed near Baghdad, he witnessed the destruction wrought by IEDs on the lives of his men, and also the murderous toll taken of civilian lives by U.S. soldiers at military checkpoints. He was also part of the first siege on Fallujah. Boudreau became torn by the two contradictory missions he'd been charged with, one to win the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people, the other to serve the American occupation by wiping out a native insurgency. And a third mission toward him, to defend the lives of his men. That was a mission closest to his heart, but it came into conflict with both winning hearts and minds and serving U.S. military policy in Iraq. When Boudreau returned from Iraq, he was given perhaps the most difficult assignment of all, to let parents and wives know their Marines had been wounded in war. He resigned his commission in April 2005 and left the Marines. Tyler Boudreau's brutally honest and searing memoir, Packing Inferno, reveals the life of a soldier with all its contradictory emotions, blind rage and battle euphoria, crushing boredom and overwhelming fear, pride and shame, and, as an officer, ambition and cynicism. It was not an easy memoir to write, as Tyler Boudreau tells us. Well, Tyler, before we start talking about your book, I'd like you to read this section here. This comes from a little bit into the book, actually quite a ways into the book, and set us up. Tell us, first of all, where does this come from?
Well, this passage is talking about the process of creating a narrative, but also for me, creating the book Packing Inferno. So the writing process and the recovery process become one, which I didn't actually realize until I was into my third iteration of the book. I had come home first and written a novel, which was, you know, very large and unwieldy, and then I had transformed that, the ideas that I wanted to get across, into a nonfiction, but it was an analysis. It still wasn't a memoir. There wasn't anything about me in it. And then finally, the last iteration was Packing Inferno. And what I sort of realized was that this was a process going on here. When I first came home, there were a lot of things I was feeling and wanting to say, but wasn't able to say them myself, and so needed these fictional characters to say them for me. Unfortunately, the book was absolutely terrible and wasn't going to go anywhere, so it required revision. I mean, the writing was poor. That was part of it, but it was also the ideas were not cohesive, and that was the mental state that I was in as well. It wasn't just that the story wasn't well formulated. It was that my mind wasn't, my narrative was not well formulated as well.
The novel, you mean?
Well, both my personal narrative and the story, both were not they were very sort of fragmented, and that's the way my memories were. As I get into the analysis, I know that I really want to get certain points across, but I'm still reluctant to say, this is what I saw, this is how I felt about it. So everything is very is in the third person, very, you know, analytical, logical. But what I found was that this manuscript was uninspiring, and people were sort of looking at me very sort of wearily and saying, wow, that's terrific, man. But they were very uninspired, and I realized that there was something wrong, and so I go again back to revise. But as I'm revising, I'm not just revising the sentences. I'm revising my personal narrative again. I'm revising the memory until finally I'm willing to put me back into the story. And as soon as I inject I into the story, I can really start to do some intense revision. And the revision, the mechanical manipulation of words and even punctuation has an effect on the, you know, on my own mental process, and I'm sort of reconstructing the memory, and now I'm sort of enabling myself to ask this narrative questions and work with it and sort of discover new answers. The more I develop this narrative. So this is what this passage is all about.
So you're really finding your voice in this passage here. Why don't you read it for us?
Okay, so, they say war is hell, but I say it's the foyer to hell. I say that a lot. I say coming home is hell, and hell ain't got no coordinates. You can't find it on the charts, because there ain't no charts. Hell is no place at all, so when you're there, you're nowhere, you're lost. The narrative, that's your chart, your own story. There are guys who come home from war and live 50 years without a narrative. 50 years lost. They don't know their own story, never have and never will. But they're moving amidst the text every day and every long night without even realizing it. They're out there beyond the wire, trudging through the sentences, tangled in the verbs, suffocating on the adjectives, wrecked by the names. They live inside the narrative like a cell, and their only escape is to understand its dimensions. Once you get it, maybe you can start tearing down the walls. Every soldier's mind is different. There is no single code to break. It's ever-changing. I don't have a recipe, but there's one thing I do know, and that is the power of the narrative. Put the story together. Understand the story. Ask questions of the story. Make it answer you. Make it. You don't take no for an answer. You find the answer. You keep building that narrative until the answer comes around. That's the low road out of hell.
That's not only war is hell, but that's also the narrative as war. You say a little bit later in the book, in fact, a little bit later from this passage, you say that emotions are the topography of our memories. What are the emotions that drive your memories of the war in Iraq?
I think a lot of sadness. I think that's one of the sadness and anger, I think, would have to be the two most memorable emotions for me. There was some considerable joy as well, but that wasn't as long lasting throughout the deployment. You know, anger and sadness were the most prevalent. The moments of joy were associated with action. When an intense fight was in the process, and usually when it was over, there was that adrenaline rush. But for the most part, the days were very, very long, and I spent a lot of time accumulating information and putting together all the stories and trying to work with the plan of how we're going to do this mission, how we're going to carry our, you know, conduct ourselves day in and day out. And it just seemed to me, over the long haul, a fruitless endeavor. And to add to that fruitlessness were the casualties on our side. And I knew about the casualties on the side of the Iraqis, and they were not all necessarily insurgents. We had a line of cars in our camp along a fence line, and they were riddled with holes, and the seats were filled with blood. And these were cars that we had shot at checkpoints. They had not stopped. They had not stopped at our checkpoints for whatever reasons. And so our Marines had engaged them, shot into the windshields, And, you know, these Iraqis had either died or been wounded. And these cars just sat there in our camp, and I would see them day in and day out. And it was a reminder of the difficult task that we had.
You say anger. Could I use the word rage?
Yeah, rage took place much more in the aftermath. Not as much rage there, but definitely some deep-seated anger, particularly when we would get casualties. Frustration, intense frustration, because we had been sent there with this task of helping Iraqi people and you know, going around with money for projects to build schools or clinics or whatever it was that we were going to try to do, water purification and all these sorts of things. And so when we would take casualties, it would be intensely frustrating. And also, of course, a friend has been wounded or someone you know. So that's, it's all sort of compounds into that anger. But the rage really is most intense and sort of inexplicable after I get home.
We're talking with former Marine Captain Tyler Boudreau about his experiences in the Marines and especially fighting in Iraq and how that changed him. His memoir is Packing Inferno. Well, let's unpack some of these emotions there. And I want to start first with the innocence with which you came into Iraq. And I think that's a word that really came to me from this passage. And this is a long one that I'd like to have you read, because it really describes, as you just said, the ideas that you came in with, the mission that you came in with, and how difficult, we already get a hint of how difficult it will be for you to contain the contradictions of that mission in your mind, in your heart, in your soul in Iraq. And in this, you're on your way north into the country to begin with.
So this passage is talking about my initial ride up into Iraq from Kuwait, and we were driving as a convoy up toward the Baghdad area. And one of the things that our commanding general, General Mattis, had encouraged us to do was to wave at the Iraqi people, because he said, this is how we're going to show them our humanity. And I think that he was very serious about trying to befriend the Iraqi people. And we, as officers, I think took it fairly seriously as well. I mean, every individual is different, but collectively I'd say we took it seriously. And he said, look, every time you see an Iraqi person, we want you to wave and smile. And so, that's what we tried to do. As we were driving north, we've got our rifles in one hand, and with the other hand we're waving and we're smiling at the people. And I was a little skeptical about that plan, but I was also surprised to see that as we were driving north, that there were a lot of people that we'd see who would smile and wave back at us. So this interaction was the first time I interacted with any Iraqi people at all in country, and I was very self-conscious and nervous at this point. So let's see. I'd practiced my phrases a bit over the past several months, but I felt embarrassed trying to actually speak the language with real people, particularly at gunpoint. I felt so embarrassed, in fact, that I left my rifle in the truck. I couldn't bear to carry it out in front of them. I'd heard so many stories about the indigenous people from other Marines who'd been there during the invasion. They said Iraqis were pushy, desperate to swarm around and take whatever scraps we had to throw at them. But these people didn't swarm. They stood still, watching us. I sensed their nervousness, even over my own. I knew they were scared. The boys huddled by their father and stared at me as I climbed out of my vehicle. I looked at them with a meek smile and I waved. They waved back and slowly approached. Their trepidation was subdued by curiosity. My wave was enough to let them know it was safe. The wave tactic was growing on me all the time. Whenever our convoy stopped, each vehicle deployed, a few Marines for security. So in accordance with protocol, I began scanning the ground for concealed explosives. We'd barely touched the war. We knew nothing of it for real. Our movements weren't real yet. Our emotions weren't real. It was all pretend. We pretended gravity. We pretended to take it all very seriously. But we didn't take it completely seriously. Not yet. I paced aimlessly around for several moments looking for something I didn't know the shape of. until I glanced up and noticed that the father and his sons had fanned out and were all scanning the ground too, as if to help me find whatever it is that I'd lost. The father spoke with a smile and pointed to the ground as if to ask, "What are you looking for?" Suddenly I felt ashamed of myself. I smiled and attempted hello in Arabic. They stared at me blankly with no response. Then I tried, "Shlonik, that's how are you?" They all smiled and repeated it several times cheerfully. The little boy was most exuberant of all. He kept repeating, "Shlonik, Shlonik, Shlonik," with an encouraging tone as if to say, "That's right, you've got it." They gathered close to me now, more comfortable with my presence, and began to inspect my equipment. One of the older boys showed me his watch and asked to see mine. He suggested, through gesticulation, that we exchange them. I waved my hand and said no. The father laughed quietly and repeated to his sons in English, "No, no, no." His nervousness overwhelmed me. The boys were pointing to pieces of my gear and asking to hold them. Their father kept smiling and saying, "No, no, no." He understood. Then they pointed at my sunglasses. I felt suddenly embarrassed. How many times, I scolded myself, how many times had they told us never to speak to the Iraqi people wearing sunglasses? I snatched them off my face and cursed myself for the gaffe. The boys, apparently unfazed by my social blunder, thought I was going to give them my sunglasses. They put their hands out excitedly and their father laughed again. "No, no, no, no." Where were these people from? I wondered as I peered out across that sea of jagged teeth. Where in all this barren land did they live, and how? How could people from this mean place, so empty and so unforgiving, be so kind to me, a soldier of an occupying force? I cannot recall a place or a time before or after when I ever felt so keenly aware of my battle gear, my helmet, my flak jacket, my cartridge belt, and my pistol. I was never so conscious of my uniform. It all seemed so very foolish suddenly. I wanted to strip it all away, peel it away like poison skin, throw my weapon and my ammunition and my protective gear back into the truck, put my arm around this man and say to him, "Let's just forget about all this war business. Let's have a cup of chai and settle this like men, just you and I, and I'll tell my friends here to put their guns away too until we've figured it all out." That's what I wanted to do, but of course I couldn't, so I didn't. I felt deeply ashamed as I climbed back into my gun truck and pressed further into his homeland, waving incessantly along the way.
It's almost as if here, at the first time that you've met them, that Iraqis are the most human for you of your whole tour in Iraq. Am I overstating that?
It went back and forth. My emotions and my feelings about the Iraqis were constantly in flux. And I talk about this later in the book, where there are times when I look at them and love their culture and love who they are and I love how they present themselves. And I think, well, these are wonderful people. And then there were other times when I did not feel that way. There are times when I felt a real hatred for every Iraqi person that I saw, whether I knew them or whether I didn't know them. And usually those times were associated with our casualties.
So what is warring inside you? What are the sides of you? What are the selves that are warring?
Well, I think that it's, to sort of use a cliche, sort of an identity crisis, and it's a war of identities, because it's not enough for me to say, well, I just disagree with the war and I'm going to go ahead and continue to be a Marine. Can't do that. Got to decide whether if you want to be a Marine, you're going to have to go along with the war. So the first step is to say, okay, I'm not a Marine anymore. Now I'll just be the former Marine, culturally conservative guy, watching the football games, but I just don't agree with the war. But you find that every step along the way, there's a conflict. Well, everybody else who's used to hang around me and, drink beers and watch football games and those sorts of things that I knew, they were all supporting the war and supporting the military. So now I've got a further problem. And then there's the type of work that I want to do. Is a particular job, an industry, for instance, that might support the war? It gets very complicated for your identity. And the further you peel it apart, the more difficult it becomes to find your place in society.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with former Marine Captain Tyler Boudreau about his memoir, Packing Inferno. Well, in that trajectory from, where you began, where you were committed to the mission that you thought was freedom, liberation, to save the Iraqi people, to the point where now you are where you where you're divided against yourself, where you're against the war. How did that happen? What was the point at which you saw? What was the point at which you turned the corner, where you saw the direction in which you had been going was no longer possible for you?
I don't think that there was a single point in time. I think what happens is there's a lot of conflicted emotions inside, and it starts to separate very slowly. And I sense the separation within me. And when I say separation, I mean this. Before the war started, I had some skepticism about the mission in general. I was stationed at the Marine Corps Recruit Depot. I was training new recruits.
And you'd been in the military, some 10 years now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, about a decade. Mm-hmm. So when the U.S. invaded Iraq, I was skeptical about that. But at the same time, I had been an infantry Marine for this 10 years and very anxious to finally test my mettle in battle, which is something that I just, due to circumstances, kept on missing out on. Even though I had been active duty during the Gulf War, I didn't get sent over. And so there was a desire to go, and there was a desire to rationalize somehow. And it so happened that a reasonable justification was offered to me. Well, Saddam Hussein is gone, and he was a bad egg, and now we're going to liberate the people, and we're going to help them. We're going to help them into this new world, into this democracy, into this freedom, and this American way of living. And I said, all right, well, I can live with that. And then there's some bad guys over there that you can go ahead and get in a fight with, and they, that'll satisfy that need as well. And I realize now, and I may have even suspected at the time, that this was sort of a faulty rationalization, and that it was going to come back to bite me. I may have suspected a little bit of that. There was also the need as an officer to protect and serve my Marines, meaning that as a leader, I would hope of myself that I could lead them through dangerous situations and get as many home as possible. That's a common desire for officers and leaders, to get their Marines home alive. And that means fighting through successfully. So there's your thought process. I will be as good a Marine and fighter as possible in the interest of getting my Marines home alive. And that's faulty logic, ultimately, because it's in conflict with achieving a mission. Oftentimes, it's not good enough to say, well, we're just going to do it really well so we can get as many Marines home as possible. And the reason why that is because there are certain missions. You can't place the welfare of your troops above the mission. Okay, you've got to be able to put the mission above the troops. In other words, you've got to be able to sacrifice their lives to achieve something. Because if their lives were, in fact, the priority, you just wouldn't do the dangerous job. So you've got to do the dangerous job. Therefore, they become deprioritized.
Well, a question I have is that the mission, as it was presented to you, and as you show in the passage that you read, was to win the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people. And yet, on the other hand, and if you truly won the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people, well, presumably your soldiers, the men under your command, would be safer, because, in fact, the war would be won and there would be no more need of it. So what was the mission?
Well, let me try to
what I'm trying to say?
Yeah. Let me explain to you how this kind of develops. We go there with the best of intentions. We go there with the idea that we're going to, to do these projects that I talked about. And the sense that we get of ourselves is that we're going to act in the role of policemen. We're just going to patrol the streets, just as you'd see a policeman patrolling the streets, and just be peacekeepers. But that doesn't really turn out to be the way it is, because policemen don't get shot at regularly from the sides of the streets. They don't have these roadside bombs. They don't have RPGs sailing at them from the alleys. And if they did, I can guarantee you they'd behave much differently than they do. And we behaved much differently once that began happening to us. Here's the tricky thing about Iraq, and this is something that everybody has heard about Iraq, is that the enemy is invisible because they don't wear uniforms. It's not a conventional force that we're fighting. It's insurgents. And so they wear civilian clothes and they blend in with the populace, so you don't know one from another. The effect this has on the individual Marine or soldier is that he doesn't know where the threat is coming from, and therefore everybody he sees on the street is a potential threat. Everybody is looked upon with suspicion. And this is one of the central points that I try to make to people. When you are in a street or a room or among a crowd who you are completely suspicious of, because anybody could be a threat, you're not opening yourselves up to them. You're not trying to win their hearts and mind. You're trying to stay alive. You're trying to figure out who the bad guy is and try to get home or get to the end of the patrol or the deployment or whatever alive and protect your fellow Marines or soldiers. And so what happens is this ideal of liberating the Iraqi people become essentially disembodied and disappear and live only as this impossible ideal, because nobody can live up to what we want the Iraqi people to be, which is sort of this flawless friend who has no concern and no doubts about our presence, and they have no emotion about a family member or friend who may have been inadvertently shot or killed in by a bomb or whatever else. I mean, all these things that we sort of call casually collateral damage, they're real people, and they have families and friends who are probably feeling some sadness about that. In a war for hearts and minds, you can't have doubts about the occupying force. Otherwise, you become, by definition, an opposition force to us, the occupiers, and you see how that kind of unravels.
And in fact, you talk about that particularly with respect, you've already mentioned it, with respect to shooting at people who are in cars at checkpoints who are coming toward you. The whole question that came up for you as soldiers, and I have to say for me, as hearing about these incidents, you know, why didn't they stop? You hear about the cars speeding up and then soldiers shooting at them, and it turns out that it was just a family, you know, and there you are left with children, with mothers, with fathers dead. And you say the toughest part about that question, why didn't they stop, was that we didn't really want to know the answer. What do you mean by that?
What I try to describe in this scenario, this checkpoint scenario where you have Marines or soldiers who are sitting in a bunker at this fixed position on a highway or a road, day in and day out, week in, week out. They can be there for very long periods of time, and the heat is tremendous, and of course the sleeping conditions and the food, everything is very difficult to cope with. And the one major threat that you deal with in this job is the car bomber. So every vehicle that approaches you can be a potential threat and maybe going to be the end of your life. And so you can imagine the anxiety mixed with the fatigue, mixed with the exasperation, all sort of combined, and the fear and maybe anger for a casualty that may have taken place. All these emotions are sitting there and basically baking in the sun, day in and out. And then you get a car that does not stop for some reason. And we don't know why each individual doesn't stop. But when it turns out to be a family, it's hard to really believe that this was just recalcitrance, that, you know, they were just being stubborn, or they're, you know, it's hard to believe that. It's very likely that they were confused, that they didn't understand how we had a lot of signs and we had a lot of reasons for them to understand, a lot of ways to express to them that that we wanted them to stop, but yet sometimes they didn't. And we would always say to ourselves, why don't they stop? And we would always conclude that they were stupid. And when people hear that, they say, well, you know, that sounds pretty racist. And I say, you know, I think it's more than that. I think that there's more to it than that. Because as soon as we start really getting into their humanity and getting into their thought process in the moment, they were confused, they were scared. Maybe they knew exactly what the Americans wanted at that moment, but maybe they were scared to stop. Maybe they heard the stories of Abu Ghraib. Maybe they don't want to be you know, taken as a detainee. Maybe they don't know what's going to happen if the Americans stop them. Maybe they think they're going to get shot anyway. There's really no telling what's going on in their mind. But to get into that thought process, to get into their humanity, is to create hesitation. And if it is a car bomber, you can't afford hesitation. And so what you do is you deliberately edge that possibility out. Whatever kind of human explanation there is for them not stopping, you edge out and you think of basically the most inhuman response that you can, which is they're stupid. These people are just stupid.
And we're talking with Tyler Boudreaux. His book is Packing Inferno. He served as an officer in Iraq and was in the Marine Corps, the U.S. Marine Corps, for 12 years. Stay tuned for more of our conversation after the break.
Let me tell you the story of a place without glory in the sandpit they call Iraq, where Abu Zarqawi and his homie jihadis decided to set up shop. The Hadjis in Qaeda were holed up inside of the mosques and the booby trap shacks, but the U.S. Marines put a dent in their dreams, and I'm half way to hell and back. Here's to the old man back in the States. Don't ever let on that they used you when you're knocking down doors to them TC whores kicking ass at the Battle of Fallujah.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Just before the break, we left off our conversation with Tyler Boudreaux talking about the shootings of what turn out to be innocent civilians that commonly occur at U.S. military checkpoints in Iraq. Boudreaux was outlining the tragic disconnect between the assumptions of the soldiers and those of the civilians, where the civilians and their fear of their soldiers may be speeding up to get through checkpoints as quickly as possible, and soldiers shoot at them because they fail to halt. Tyler Boudreaux, these kinds of incidents were, as you point out, not unusual, and they were also not the only ones that you talk about in the book where you can see the contradiction between the desire to win the hearts and minds and the reality of war and what that means for people's lives. You say the honest but unspeakable truth is that the quaint little myth of America's finest, our heroes, our soldiers, does not always fit. And when I read this, I thought, wow, this was perhaps one of the most honest things that I've read, because you always hear, you know, these are our soldiers, these are our heroes. And if I, and I, of course, I've never been to war, but if I try to put myself in the mind of somebody who is in precisely the circumstances that you were just describing, I'm thinking, how is it possible to, in fact, maintain your humanity and also save your life, fight for your brothers, do what you need to do? I mean, you're really putting people in an impossible situation.
Well, that passage you mentioned about the myth of the American soldier and Marine being the best and the brightest and the finest, it's not that none of them are. It's just that, you know, the military actually even boasts that it is a really good cross-section of America. And they mean that racially and ethnically, but that also means in other ways as well. I mean, it means you get some really outstanding, smart guys, and then you get some people who are not so smart, and you have some people who are very dutiful and you know, follow all the laws, and then you get some people who come from backgrounds who do not have much respect for the law, and they bring that with them. So you get all types, just like you get out in the street, you get all types in Iraq.
And these are also young people who are under incredible conditions of stress.
They're under conditions of stress, but as you just pointed out, they're very young, and they're young men, and you know, they have a particular type of the type of person that comes to the Marine Corps usually is a pretty feisty kind of guy, aggressive kind of guy. These are the terms in which they think, and then they come to an institution which, by definition, handles its problems through violence, and it fits them like a glove. And now we have a situation that's difficult. It's in some cases inexplicable. And what I'm trying to kind of point out to people is this is how we would solve our problems, through violence, because that's what our nature was. And I make brief mention of those individuals who might not have been the best characters and those leaders who might not have been the best leaders, but only brief mention of that, because, and there's a reason for that. Because what I really want to show is, number one, what is typical. The stories in this book are all typical. There's nothing that's really, really outlandish. It's all the kind of stories that you've probably heard again and again in the news. And so you'd nod your head and say, yeah, I've heard that about a million times. And then you take the best. Take the best leaders. Take the best Marines. Take the best soldiers. And you're going to have some serious problems. So the ones who are not good leaders and not good Marines, that's just worse. The best of the best still has a problem that's unsolvable.
And even in your case, I mean, there are many points in the book in which you say, well, you know, this is a systemic problem, that you yourself had to give orders that led to things, the kind of violence. We're not just talking about maybe, you know, I mean, how can you separate war from violence? War is violence, okay? So there's that systemic part of it. But there seems to be also the sense in which you are trapped, that there were things that you wish you could have done otherwise, but you couldn't, given the circumstances. You couldn't even tell the truth in the reports, not mm-hmm. that you actually lied, but mm-hmm. that you had to leave out so much. Mm-hmm. Talk about that.
Well, the reporting situation, I do talk about a lot, because it was a pretty central part of my job. Every day that I would draft a daily operations report about what we'd done that day. And I do point out that there were a lot of things left out. It wasn't that we left out facts. It was that we left out conclusions, possible conclusions. And we would sort of solidify things that were gray. In other words, if an Iraqi man was killed in exchange of fire, maybe he was killed in a car and he did not have a weapon, it was gray. It was hard to tell. Had he been shooting at us, jumped in his car and began to flee, and then we shot him? Or was he just an innocent bystander, you know, passing through, and then he got shot? And wherever those gray areas existed, we would always clarify and say, Iraqi insurgent killed. And then next sentence. There wasn't much explanation to it, but that's how we would kind of leave out the other possible conclusions. If you had those other types of truthful conclusions or possible conclusions, well, it would leave a lot more area for doubt about our success.
And as you point out, if you begin to doubt, you can't complete the mission. There's been a lot of talk about the incompetence of how the war was prosecuted. I'm not talking about incompetence on the level of individual officers like yours, but at the larger level, you know, how we expected the Iraqis to greet us with flowers and accolades, and, you know, the not completing schools, people not having electricity, not having water. Just the larger conduct of the war, Abu Ghraib, for example, all of these. And you have a section in your book, and I'm talking with Tyler Boudreaux about Packing Inferno. It's his memoir of his tour in Iraq in the U.S. Marines. You have a section in the book in which you talk about failure is not an option. Talk about that ideology and how that leads to failure.
Well, you said a lot. Okay, to the original portion with the incompetence at the senior levels, I mean, I wouldn't be able to speak to it, you know, thoroughly, but I would be able to say that I've always had sort of a problem with that idea of incompetence, because one of the things that I try to express in my book is these typical scenarios that were just again and again and again, and I use a voice that is hopefully very accessible, and I want to present myself as someone who is just a regular guy who's making these observations, and that's what I am. But the reason I want to make sure that people hear that is because I want them to say, well, Tyler Boudreaux is not the smartest guy around. He's just a regular guy. He's making all these obvious observations. why is nobody else making these? Why is Tyler Boudreau the only one making these observations? There's a lot of smart people and up in Washington. It's not possible for me to believe that there's that much incompetence and that everybody is dumber than I am. I'm the smartest guy. I'm smarter than everybody in Washington. That's very difficult for me to believe. And so what I say to people is that my book, Packing Inferno, is not the problem with Iraq. My book is pointing at the problem with Iraq. And I think they need to look deeper at what's going on in our government and its relationship with corporate America and natural resources, et cetera, et cetera. These are not things that I'm the expert on. I'm the expert on what I saw in Iraq, but I do think that it points at particular things that Americans need to be taking a close look at.
And that's a whole other issue that you get into that I think is a very important one, and I want to pick that up again. And we're talking with Tyler Boudreau about his memoir, Packing Inferno. But I think what I'm trying to say is that basically, if you're going to go into a country, you're going to occupy a country. No matter how lofty the ideals are, you're going to occupy it, you're going to go in with soldiers. That war itself is something that can't but fail to create rage and opposition to you among the occupied population.
What you're saying, that it's difficult for us to expect any other reaction than an insurgency. I mean, and that's sort of how I looked at it almost right away, which was they would say, well, you know, we're going to win hearts and minds. And I heard the stories of the invasion from the guys, and it was not all the, you know, they welcomed us with flowers and smiles. They talked about all the firefights, and they were proud of these firefights. They had gone from Kuwait up to Baghdad in just a number of days, and roared faster than any of even the most senior officers that I knew could believe was possible for them to roll that fast up to Baghdad. And that included a lot of shock and awe, a lot of violence, and that's not connected somehow. The winning hearts and minds and the shock and awe and the how fast we got up to Baghdad, those two things are never put together in a military mind. And that's one of the things that right away I say, I wonder how exactly they feel about this whole shock and awe campaign that we've been running. I wonder if that's going to do, you know, well with our winning hearts and minds. So, you know, there is definitely that
contradiction. So when you talk in the book about the idea that failure is not an option, and you just spoke about how not all the conclusions that one could come to could make it into your reports. What would have happened if you had put in those conclusions? What would have happened? How would you have been treated by your higher-ups if you had done that?
Let's say, for instance, I took a report in that same scenario that I described where, in fact, was a real scenario. There was an individual who was shot by a squad of Marines, and I was up on the roof with them and watched the whole thing. And the individual did not have any weapons when we went to search the vehicle. And if I were to go back to my base and write a report that said, it looks like we killed an innocent Iraqi civilian at this point, first of all, I'm pretty sure my boss would have just said, no, scratch that line, and that would have probably been the end of the conversation, but it wouldn't been the end. It would not have been the end of the sentiment. The feeling that would have been left with my boss would have been, "Where's Tyler's head right now? What's he thinking about?" And if I had done it twice or three times, there would have been a serious deterioration of his trust for me.
Exactly. Now, there have been a lot of exposés of poor conditions for veterans when they come back. Is it possible to connect what you just spoke about with the way that the veterans have been treated? That is, if you're going to deny the reality of what's going on, the conclusions that one can make, reasonable conclusions on the ground on how Iraqis are being treated, what about on how veterans are being treated? Is that part of the denial process also?
I do think that the two are connected. And this was difficult. This is a difficult one to talk about and to get people to understand. But here's the way that I describe it for people. If you are wholeheartedly supporting this war, if this is something that you believe in, you are also sort of taking for granted or supporting the use of a certain extent of force and violence. And you are, you know, you're rationalizing and however you are. You're saying, well, that's just what we have to do to get the job done, et cetera, et cetera. So when a veteran comes home and he is distraught about the things that he has done, perhaps, it's very difficult to be genuinely sympathetic for his concerns while at the same time being genuinely supportive of the methods that the military must use. And given the emphasis behind supporting troops and how one can become quickly ostracized if you don't support the troops, in many communities you wouldn't dare speak out against the war, particularly in ones heavily populated by veterans and families, military families. How do you really, really sympathize with someone who comes back and says, I am very sad or I am hurting for the things that I did? It's very difficult.
And even extending it to the physical, the devastating physical injuries. I mean, we've seen the exposés of the conditions in veterans' hospitals, for example. Does that inability to actually recognize the wreckage of war and how the fallout of war on veterans, part of this inability to say there's maybe something wrong about what we're doing over there?
It's possible. It's a possible outcome. I think that the situation with the VA has sort of historically been one where we have, you know, inadequate care. And I don't have a lot of information or experience with the VA, but you know, you hear these stories, and every time another story comes out where the, you know, where it sounds like the VA has not properly treated its veterans, I think most people kind of shrug and say, "Yep, that about figures." And I don't think it's because that the people working at the VA are negligent or bad people. What I think is that they're immensely underfunded and undersupported by the government and by the population in general. And I kind of agree with what you're saying. If we were to make the VA a really big priority, the more of a priority we make caring for veterans, the more that sense that war might not be the best thing might, you know, creep up into the, you know, collective consciousness. So I don't know if that's in anybody's mindset when they're denying funds to the VA, but it seems like that's sort of an unconscious factor.
The denial that you could say is on a large part of the American population. And I've heard a lot of veterans talk about how, you know, they come back here and it seems like nobody's really aware of the war. They're not really aware of what's going on. Or if they are, they just kind of say these platitudes. You know, for example, you were in a supermarket on one of the anniversaries of 9/11, and somebody came over, one of the people from the store came over the intercom, the PA, and said, you know, something about our heroes and that there was going to be a moment of silence. And you write about that. You say, I'm angry at all the people who turned my ideals into platitudes. I'm angry at the people who turned fighting for freedom into a hollow slogan. A hollow slogan?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the way I feel about it, because I really don't feel like the real goal, the real objective in Iraq is freedom for their people. I think that if we had wanted the best for the Iraqi people, there would have been a much different plan in place. And it wouldn't have been, you know, the main problem with our plan was that it was, you know, unilateral, and this idea of a coalition, which we always called ourselves, and then we turned ourselves into a multinational force, was, of course, ridiculous. I mean, we had 150,000 troops. Britain has 10,000. They're the next greatest force there with 10,000 troops. And then from there, it just gets into the couple of thousand and then hundreds and then just a few guys on the ground. That's not a coalition. And when you're making this kind of, when you're conducting this kind of operation, when you think that there's a real humanitarian need in the world, it can't be done unilaterally. And we need to really make an effort to get these things, you know, these situations decided in a genuinely international forum. And the reason I think that, as utopian as it sounds, is that if you had a genuinely, you know, international decision-making body, and I don't know if it's the UN or not, but, you know, we'll call it the UN, it would hold in check the forces of national self-interest and racism. Both of those things play a big role in military operations. They can't help but creep in. Even if they weren't actually part of the plan, they can't help but creep in. It's too easy to say, we've got to get into Baghdad, bomb the grid. It's just too easy to say that if you are not interested in the people that live there.
The book is Packing Inferno, and we're talking with the author, former Marine Captain Tyler Boudreau. His experience fighting in Iraq turned him against the war. He resigned his commission in 2005 and now devotes himself to working on a variety of issues supporting veterans. And you also point out that we're all complicit. I mean, you talked before about, you know, resources, natural resources. I mean, I can remember when the war started, and to me it was pretty obvious that it was all about oil, and I know I'm not the only one that was obvious to, but it seemed that when I scanned the newspapers or the media for any talk about the, you know, fundamental reason for the war, that it was about oil, that was nowhere to be seen. But I want to go beyond that. You say that we are all complicit, that we are all beneficiaries of the war to some degree. To give up war would be to give up those benefits. Could you talk more about that? And then I'm going to ask you a follow-up to it.
Well, we live in a society that is based on competition. That's our economic system is based on competition. And most people are comfortable with that idea of competition when it's one store versus the other in a neighborhood, or one company versus the other, or corporation versus the other. But as these competitions grow and grow, and the resources that they're struggling, it's not just the market that they're trying to capture. They're trying to capture the resources that are necessary to make their, you know, corporation run. The biggest competition turns out to be war, and this is a part of our system. This is how we keep our markets strong, and this is kind of what I'm describing. And we live a pretty comfortable lifestyle by and large, and there's poverty in this country, but not to the extent that there is in other countries, and there's a reason for that.
Do you feel then that war is justified in order to preserve those benefits? I mean, here, I'm not asking that question by asking you to say, well, yes, you know, we just have to do what's immoral, but really trying to unpack this in a deeper way. Is that the only way we can get these benefits? Must we do these things, these regrettable things? Or is the cost also too high for us? I mean, I wonder, after all that you have seen, all the violence, all what you have gone through, all the toll that this has taken on yourself and your friends and your country, what do you feel about the balance of this balance sheet?
This is an area that I have some instincts on and some feelings on, and I've done a little reading here and there, but I'm not an expert on these things, and I haven't figured out the answers on them. I don't really believe that we have to have hegemony to have the benefits that we have. We may not be able to live in exactly the same style that we do, but I'm not sure that we want to live in the same style that we do. And these are just my ideas. I don't know what's possible or not. I mean, this is a very, very deep and complex question. It goes into the questions of humanity. It goes into the questions of capitalism. And it goes into the questions of, you know, anthropology. It's this is difficult.
Human nature.
Yeah.
And my final question is, in your book, you say that the real rage started after you came back. And I guess that's, you know, one of the costs that I see here. What is that rage about? Why more rage when you came back?
This is something that's not something I can completely explain. I don't know exactly why it always works out that the rage is greater when veterans return, but it seems to be very common. And for me, a lot of the rage was just coming up from the inside and not explicable, very inexplicable. But there was also some rage that was connected with some concrete ideas. And one of them was the things we've been talking about, which is, you know, people's kind of willful ignorance with respect to the nature of war. And I always kind of had a very pragmatic view of war before, thinking that, okay, well, you know, war is just what we, you know, sometimes we have to do this thing, and this is my attitude as an officer. But I always had a very realistic attitude. If it's practical, if it's necessary, if this is just what we have to do, then people need to be okay with what it really takes. If you are willing to make an argument that war is absolutely what we need for our national security or for our resources or whatever it is that the argument you're making, then you need to also be very comfortable with the casualties that we take and the casualties that we inflict. And if you're not comfortable with those things, then we need to reevaluate. And then we can have a more honest discussion about whether or not we want to engage in this activity. I won't decide preemptively whether any war in all wars is or not just, but we do need to get to a place where everybody's comfortable with the language. And I don't think that we are collectively comfortable with the language if we are not able to see the blood in the news. I mean, you know, you watch the news and you wouldn't think that it was a dangerous place at all if you depended on the news. And yet we know that war is dangerous. We know because of the people that come home wounded or killed. We also know from movies of older wars, and we know of novels. And yet our own news, which is supposed to be telling us what's happening in the most honest way, is not showing one iota of violence. And it, you know, it really, I think, makes this impression that it's not so bad.
Aside from writing this book, Packing Inferno, what kinds of other activities are you involved in around this war, around talking to people about it?
All right, so I'm doing a lot of projects under an organization that I've established, which is Collaborative Revolution, which does a number of projects related to developing a community consciousness and developing empathy in people. And this is kind of a long story, but it sort of, in my mind, is the antithesis of the behavior that I had to harness in Iraq to fight. You know, this dehumanization, this, this real detachment from humanity. And now I'm trying to go the other way and really build up my own empathy, but also try to develop it in other people, because I think that there's a lot of apathy out there, and so I'm trying to increase the empathy. And one of the projects that I'm working on for next summer is I'm cycling cross country. It's called the Other Side Cross Country Cycle Tour, and this is a trip that I'll be taking with veterans who are dealing with physical disabilities and post-traumatic stress. And the idea is, we're going to be, you know, making this trip to accomplish some healing, some individual healing, but we'll also be stopping in communities along the way to discuss these realities of war. And so there'll be, a community benefit as well. And so that's what we're going to do.
Tyler Boudreau, thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice and for writing this powerful, honest, and I have to say, brilliantly written book, Packing Inferno.
Thank you for having me.
Tyler Boudreau blogs at deeperthanwars.blogspot.com. You can find a link both to his blog and to his website, tylerboudreau.com, at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.